great to see everyone here this evening. And as was mentioned earlier, this is the last chapter of the book of Judges. And as our title indicates, this is not one year. I challenge everyone in this room, find me a children's illustrated Bible that has this story in it. And I will pay you. I haven't figured out an amount, but I would pay full money to see that. This chapter is one that has really challenged me, and I don't know if you all noticed by the questions, but initially I kind of approached this chapter a lot different than how I ended up studying the chapter. It challenged me to look at it differently. So I'm hoping for a very interesting discussion this evening. And there's some things I think that are initial hindrances to all of us just because we are removed from this time period and from this culture. So there are some things that are difficulties for modern readers. For one, we're unfamiliar with the original language. There's about five or six words tonight that I looked at that gave me a different impression from what the translation seems to indicate. So just from the original language alone, we're at a disadvantage. Not that this is a bad translation, but it does bear some looking into and some clarifications. We're unfamiliar with the concept of holy war. So what took place in chapter 20, we're unfamiliar with that, and I think as modern readers, we're a little bit uncomfortable with some of these things that take place. And so that puts us at a disadvantage. We're unfamiliar, really, with the importance of inheritance. Of course, we still have inheritance today, but it's nothing like what they received then. And we're unfamiliar with the importance of having 12 tribes. So that's one of the things that we'll notice here in chapter 21. We're unfamiliar with how marriages were formed, both the ones that were ideal and, as we will see here in this chapter, the less than ideal, the non-ideal, and particularly for women in that era of time, how they were formed and what their responsibility and part in that was. And number six, and this is what I really felt, we're unfamiliar with God's Old Testament expectations and provisions for such situations. God's Old Testament law, the law of Moses, addressed many of the things that happened in chapters 20 and 21. And we need to be more familiar with that, and hopefully we will by the end of this study. We need to put ourselves back in 1300s BC and try to figure out what exactly is going on here. So someone will have to remind me who had the last question. Trace did? Okay, so Lauren will have question number one. What is the significance of the oath that all the people made about Benjamin, and why did they make such an oath? Verses 1 through 7.
The eighth part, the men of Benjamin would not be able to obtain wives. In the last chapter, verse 48, the cities and all that were in them were destroyed, so anybody that had an existing wife, their wife was now dead and their children were dead, and so it was just these men, 600 guys left at the Rock of River. If they were following Old Testament law, they were forbidden to marry Canaanite women, so really the only other option that I saw available was that they could go to war with a far outside tribe, perhaps enslave some women that way. The B part, why did they make such an oath? Some of the commentators thought it was rash. Looking at it, perhaps they just didn't want their daughters marrying the perverted men of Benjamin or the men who supported the perverted men of Benjamin. Mm-hmm.
Other comments here on question number one? Bill?
I want to point out their obligation to their oath. They weren't willing to back down. They made a couple of oaths here, and they're going to hold to them. People make oaths all the time nowadays. and a person's word doesn't mean a whole lot. I give them credit for hanging on to their word.
Yeah, absolutely. You do have to respect that. The seriousness that they took an oath, and I believe this is an oath that they made before the Lord. So they placed the utmost seriousness upon it when they made it, and even though it would have consequences, dire ones, they didn't back down from it, so you have to respect them. Mark?
Yeah, so I think the reason they made this oath is because they're putting the tribe of Benjamin under the ban. We've talked about holy, you mentioned holy war in your introduction. And so they're treating Benjamin as a Canaanite tribe. And in Deuteronomy chapter 7, the Lord said concerning the Canaanites in verse 2, you shall make no covenant with them or show mercy to them, nor shall you make marriages with them. You shall not give your daughter to their son or take their daughter for your son, for they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods. So remember, Phinehas is here. Phinehas is the one in the in Bethel, you know, at the Ark of the Lord. And so he's advising the people, and they're having a council. And this is the advice, and the Bible doesn't tell us if they consulted with God on this, but they had to have consulted Phinehas, or having a powwow. And Phinehas is like, they're under the ban. And part of the ban is you can't give your daughters or your sons to them to be married. So that's why they made this vow, I believe. We're not told that explicitly. But because they killed everybody, which is exactly what they were told to do during Holy War, I think extend that reasoning to that's why they weren't.
Right. Well, I think it's interesting. It does seem to be a Canaanitish treatment that they're giving it, but I think this is the same passage that Bill pointed out last week that kind of caused me to rethink this. And I think it's Deuteronomy 13 that's actually being implemented here in Judges chapter 20. And this is talking about one of your cities which the Lord God gives you to dwell in. So I'm not sure that this is totally Canaanitish in the way that that it's being described here. It seems to be one in which after they had went in and possessed it, and then people come in and entice the inhabitants for idolatrous treatment, and then they're utterly destroyed and completely burned with fire, and so on and so forth. Like Bart was saying, it's the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Girgashites, and so on and so forth, that you're not to make particularly covenants with them and marriages. You're not to do that with. But I'm not sure that's what's in view here in Deuteronomy 13. And I think, this is my opinion, I think there's a rash treatment, and maybe even in the face of zeal, they want to do what's right after they have done what's wrong for so long. And as a result of that, they go ahead and they make an oath that shouldn't be applied to their own brethren. It should have been applied to the Canaanites and to the people that are actually mentioned here, but not necessarily to the Israelites. And I think that's where the conflict in this chapter is really coming from. Now, that's my opinion, but I encourage conversation, rebuttal, I suppose, against that. Bill?
That last underlined phrase in your Deuteronomy 13 quote, it shall not be built again. I'm talking about the cities. In verse 23, at the end, then they went and returned to their inheritance, and they rebuilt the cities and dwelt in them. So there's maybe a version of that.
Yeah. There's something going on there. I'm not sure who's at fault. Or if there is fault. But there's some things in this chapter, even some more subtle things that we're going to have to figure out. One of those is the fact that they built an altar in verse 4. I believe it's Leviticus 17. We were talking about it in class today. It was talking about the fact that they were not supposed to make any other altars to God. I was asking my professor about it a little bit, and he said, you know, Judges, you kind of notice the absence of the tabernacle in the book of Judges. And that kind of makes sense, that we haven't really talked about the tabernacle very much in the book of Judges, where people are trying to serve the Lord, but they're off just a little bit. Things aren't quite the way that they needed to be. And of course, we do have mention of the tabernacle, the house of the Lord, here in this chapter. But the fact that they made another altar is another indication that things are just off just a little bit, I think. Yeah, Mark?
And that's certainly a valid opinion, but you still have to deal with the Phinehas. Phinehas is there, right? So you
right.
have to indict Phinehas if you're going to take that position. Then you have to say the priest himself, this very glorious figure in Israelite history, is also misleading the people into doing this. So I understand your position, and I certainly want to take. But and in this Deuteronomy 13 quote, it's talking about idolatry. It's not talking about what has occurred in Judges 20 necessarily. We don't know that there was idolatry. There could have been idolatry. All
right.
we know is that there was violence.
Right.
Homosexuality and violence. And that specifically, not rebuilding the city, applies to idolatry.
Other comments? I'm not sure about the Phinehas thing. I'm not sure how good of a, not to throw him under the bus necessarily, but the children of Israel did lose for 2 days that we had talked about with the possibility of being sent in the camp anyway. And it's only after several sacrifices are made. And these are offerings that are made at the house of God there in verse 26. So there's one commentator that talked about maybe they built another altar to try to balance out the number of sacrifices, that they had so many going on that they needed a second one. But that still seems to be a deviation from the law. So, and I think you could even say that without really... Phinehas was just one guy. And I think as this chapter ends, it indicates everyone's just kind of doing what they think is right in their own lives, right? They're doing their what they think is right. Phinehas is there, and obviously he's trying to toe the line, but we're talking about people that aren't really listening all that hard, perhaps. Any other comments before we move on? Okay. This is not the first time someone in the Bible has made a stupid oath. And I believe that that's essentially what's going on here. I think this is a foolish oath. And I think that it's because of the oath that Benjamin was ultimately going to end. That it was not the Lord himself. So you remember that Jephthah made a foolish oath. Saul, we'll read later in 1 Samuel 14, made a pretty foolish oath. The word in verse 2, the same, the Hebrew word, for grieved really means to be sorry or to repent. In verse 15, it's the Greek word in the Septuagint of parakaleo, and that means, that's where we get the get our word for pray, to ask, to beg, to plead, to comfort, encourage, exhort, urge, to call, or to invite. Verse 3 talks about... How there was going to be a tribe missing. That's translated elsewhere as lacking. It has the idea of numbering. In fact, the majority of the times that it's used in the Bible, it's talking about when something was numbered. So it's not that God was just going to wipe Benjamin, or that his plan was to wipe Benjamin off the face of the earth, but that they were severely lacking in number. That's my take, at least. Any other comments on that before? Just through kind of some information. All right, let's move on to question number 2 from Malin. Where is Jabesh Gilead, and why were they destroyed except for the 400 virgins? Was this action from the Lord, or was it something that the people decided to do without consulting God?
Yeah, so, I mean, Jabesh Gilead here, it's a city in Gilead, in the eastern part of Manasseh. I don't know if you have a map there. Yeah, there you go. So it's 15 miles east of the Jordan, so kind of between the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea there. Yeah. So they, the second part here, they were destroyed because they, well, they didn't go up and fight with the rest of the children of Israel against the Benjamites.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see that they, you know, I was kind of curious, like, why, we're not really told exactly why they didn't go fight, you know, it's kind of unclear on that. If they maybe were supporting the Benjamites somehow, maybe they were okay with it. Perhaps another reason, but yeah, that was what I found on that one. And the last part, yeah, also they, I guess the second part to this, is that they needed wives, the remaining Benjamites at the Rock of Rimmon, I believe, they needed 600, there were 600 men there, and so they were trying to find wives for them. So the last part here was this action from the Lord, and that's another thing we're not really told exactly. You know, in verse 3 and 4, you know, I think they were trying to do what was right. We talked about that a little bit, but you know, it said that in 3 and 4, verses 3 and 4 we're reading, that they, well, actually 4 says they rose the next morning, built an altar, and burned offerings and peace offerings. So you know, they were trying to seek the Lord, it appeared. But we don't really know exactly if this was the plan that the Lord wanted. So I think that's pretty much all I have to say.
Very good. Other comments here on question two? So, Bart?
Okay.
So I have this this passage up here. And I think this is worth remembering when we talk about this particular action, this is brutal. It just is, from no matter how you look at it. But let's remember that God foresaw something like this already. And God had stipulations. So Deuteronomy 21 verse 10 says, when you go out to war against your enemies, and the Lord your God delivers them into your hand, and you take them captive, and you see among the captives a beautiful woman, desire her, and will take her for your wife, then you shall bring her home to your house, and she shall shave her head and trim her nails. She shall put off the clothes of her captivity, remain in your house, and mourn her father and her mother a full month. After that you may go into her and be your husband, and she shall be your wife. And it shall be, if you have no delight in her, then you shall set her free, but you certainly shall not sell her for money. You shall not treat her brutally because you have humbled her. So, essentially, there are some protections here that God builds in for such a situation. So, yes, what happened at Jabesh-Gilead is rough. I think we can kind of read between the lines. I do believe that this was an action that was at least approved by God. They get similar treatment to how the people of Benjamin get, right? So they don't come up to an official summons. It's not like they didn't know what was going on. Everyone knew in the land of Israel what was happening and why they were supposed to be there. I think it's Kaufman that talks about the fact that Jabesh-Gilead was related by blood to Gibeah according to 1 Chronicles 7, 12 through 15. So that would be an interesting connection there if there was a blood relation, and that's why they didn't go up, similar to the rest of the tribe of Benjamin saying, we're going to defend Gibeah. But the result is the same. They go in and they utterly destroy it. They do take the 400 back and gave them as wives to the Benjamites. So we have these verses here again about prisoners of war, and that's what they were. They were. I think we can see here that this isn't. They're not being mistreated in this transit or in giving them as wives. Certainly by 21st century American standards they are, but that's not what's under consideration. Again, we can't read this with modern reader's eyes. We have to put ourselves back here in this particular time. Other comments? Yeah, Mark.
I agree. A couple things. It's interesting that...
No, go ahead.
12,000 men go, and we're not told they killed everybody. It says the setup for that is that that's what's going to happen. The Bible doesn't emphasize that. And then later, the men of Jabesh-Gilead in the book of Samuel, the survivors, favor the Benjamites, you know, because they're the ones, the men of Jabesh Gilead, go and get the bodies of Saul and Jonathan down off the wall, the Benjamite king. And so whoever survived out of this, they had a soft spot in their heart for the tribe of Benjamin, and they liked Benjamin. I think that's a neat connection that we can see in the book of Samuel. Let's remember that this attack on Jabesh Gilead isn't unprecedented. Remember Gideon. Gideon crossed over the Jordan chasing the armies of the Midianites and asked two cities to help him on the way. And they said, no, you go ahead and take care of that. And when Gideon finished the battle, he wheeled back around and he leveled those cities and killed every last person in those two cities. Those were Israelite cities. Mm-hmm. So this is not unprecedented. This is something that's happened before. And I love your point about these women are treated as wives, right? It's not something that's a slave or whatever. These women are treated as wives by the Benjamites. So again, by our standards, it's a terrible thing, but by ancient standards, they're wives to these Benjamite soldiers.
Right. We'll talk a little bit more about their treatment later. Or I'm hoping maybe we might. Jephthah is another example of killing Israelites. He kills, what is it, 42,000?
I think. Maybe I was confusing Gideon and Jephthah. Is
nope.
Jephthah
the Gideon.
Oh, Gideon does too?
Yeah, Gideon does too.
I should have looked that up, but I just remember that some of the judges do that.
Yeah, you're right. Well, technically this, I think maybe this would be later, but it's not unprecedented in the Bible that this would occur. It's something that happens when you have people in the Bible, in the children of Israel, that are going against whatever God's instructions are, whatever, really against the law and against the national interest, we might even say, particularly with Gideon and with Jephthah. Lord?
Well, I read between the lines a little bit differently. So they go and they ask the Lord here, but we're not told that he answers it. In the previous chapter, we're definitely told that the Lord directs them to go against Benjamin. Here we're not given that information. So in my mind, it was possibly a no by silence. And then another thing I was wondering about, I don't know if we'll try to discuss this later, but later on in this chapter, we talk about the festival at Shiloh, and this is in Mizpah. There is some speculation that the tabernacle had maybe already moved back up to Shiloh this time, and maybe Phinehas wasn't there.
Okay. Yeah, that would make some sense, too. Like you said, Lord, this is, reading between the lines, it's really hard to tell because we don't have a definitive answer from God. And that, of course, blurs the lines. So they could just be taking this into their own hands. Bill?
Yeah, I found verse 13 kind of interesting. I was trying to understand learn, you know, this act of announcing peace to them. What did this amount to? And I found two different people wrote about Josephus, his writings, that there were confessions of these surviving Benjamites of, yeah, our brothers were wrong, we were wrong in supporting them. And then there was, you know, it was like a love fest and they made up, kissed and made up is what it kind of sounded like. But I couldn't hardly find any information on it. I really don't know what that amounted to.
It's hard to find a lot of information about this chapter period because most commentators, like most people, kind of want to skip over it. But I think that does have some merit to it as far as the kind of trying to make peace with one another. Again, the word grieved means to be sorry, to repent. And again, we have this word. You have a void or a breach. And another word, according to Strong's, would be a break. I think that, and this is verse 15, the people grieved for Benjamin because the Lord had made a void in the tribes of Israel. Again, it's not that the Lord was trying to blank out Benjamin,
but rather that he broke them and so that they could be rehealed. And I think because we know the history of Benjamin moving forward, such as King Saul, such as Ehud, and of course later the Apostle Paul, was it Esther and Mordecai, also from the tribe of Benjamin. So there are many people that are used in God's plan and even in the scheme of redemption in some ways, with Paul being the apostle of the Gentiles, that Benjamin was needed. So if you work back from that standpoint, and this is what was bothering me, because my initial approach to this chapter was that God defeated Benjamin, and then the children of Israel went back in and started meddling with what God wanted defeated. And that's why Benjamin exists. So that's why I'm going over this. That is not the case. But what was going to cut off, is interesting there in verse 6. It talks about one tribe is cut off from Israel today. What shall we do for wives, for those who remain? The tribe that's cut off, how are they cut off? Because there's still people from that tribe remaining, but they're cut off because of this oath that they make. They are going to be cut off because they can't scripturally, righteously, go out and procure wives for themselves, and thus meaning the end of Benjamin because of this particular oath. So to me, that is how this tribe was being cut off, and I think that's why the people are upset about the absence of the tribe, because they are the ones that are causing it, rather than God being the cause of the annihilation of Benjamin. That's my thought, that's my opinion. But interested to hear what y'all think. Martin?
Well, I mean, I think all of the events in this chapter are ordained by the Lord. And we can get into this a little bit later, but I think I believe Phinehas was advising the tribes on how to approach the situation, and that he told them that this was a ban because of the wickedness that had permeated, a little leaven leavens the whole lump. And that's what had happened in Benjamin. And God strikes the nation or the tribe of Benjamin just as he struck the tribe of Israel, the nation of Israel later. And you have to purge out the evil. So I don't see, what I see is at the end of the chapter when it says people mended what was right in their own eyes because there was no king, that's talking about Gibeah and the Benjamites. I think the follow-up action of the tribes of Israel was the appropriate thing. And no way to say with certainty, as you and Lauren both pointed out, it's left a little bit. But I would say in my mind that if indeed the Lord wasn't behind these actions, there probably would be some severe consequences for the other tribes. I just think we're watching the punishment be dealt to Benjamin, and then we have the reparations necessary for them to continue. And as you point out, they're purged, they become clean. The wives that are taken, the virgin wives that are taken, become one with these men. They become families and strong families, and they're the only tribe that stays faithful to Judah. Mm-hmm. And so that's part of the reason I think this is from God, because those other women perhaps were corrupt, the ones that were killed.
Yeah. Those are
good thoughts. And like you said, to find a definitive answer for this chapter is very difficult, hence the difficulty of the chapter. Let's move on to question number 3, Logan.
Why did the other tribes want to ensure the continuation of Benjamin when it says the Lord had made a void in Israel? Again, this is what I was talking about just a second ago. Did the Lord want Benjamin to continue, and what yearly feast was happening at Shiloh? Verse 16 through 19.
Yeah, we kind of answered most of this question already, I feel like. Benjamin's still a tribe in Israel, right? We're still family. And it's because of this oath that people are mourning and grieving over them. So yeah, they still feel as if, you know, they should continue, that they shouldn't be completely wiped out. And that's just the general sentiment in Israel at this time. Did the Lord want Benjamin to continue? Well, previous questions, verse 15, and the people grieved for Benjamin because the Lord had made a void in the tribes of Israel. Well, I guess if you really, really wanted to, you could look at it both ways, but I'm fairly certain that, you know, the Lord is in control here. We know that He is. And so, you know, you can make the point that the Lord, as you said in the previous question, He's breaking them, but He's not erasing them out of this. He's in control, and He's going to make it so that Benjamin will continue. And as for this yearly feast that's happening, all I have is that all these commentators are in, you know, complete disarray. They don't really know. You know, there's no consensus. Some commentators say that it is the Passover. There's others that say it's the Feast of the Tabernacles. And then even some others believe that it was a local festival particular to Shiloh. So, yeah, just a bunch of different opinions.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know your thoughts on that.
Any other thoughts on question number 3?
Just a little history of this. Benjamin was the youngest.
Yeah.
He was the one of two born to Rachel. Rachel died in childbirth, naming him Son of Sorrow, and then he was renamed Son of My Right Hand. They probably called him Little Benjamin because he's called that in Psalm 68, Little Benjamin. And he's the only one that didn't betray Joseph. The only one of Jacob's sons that did not betray Joseph. And the two tribes that are representing Joseph are Ephraim and Manasseh. And so that has to be in their mind that this is the only tribe that didn't betray our father way back then. So perhaps that's why they grieved so
terribly. Yeah, that would be a good explanation also. Other again, we've talked a little bit about this. And as far as I was thinking about this, with every defeat that God makes, the enemy is completely destroyed, and we have to assume that the 600 men at the Rock of Bremen were left alive for a reason by God, and I think we've established that. But I do think that there's a parallel in the New Testament, and this is why we don't fully understand the importance of the number 12 and the importance of ensuring that all 12 tribes exist. Because we see a similar example with the 12 apostles in Acts chapter 1. So the appointment of Matthias after the fall of Judas. He has obtained a part in this ministry. He was numbered with us. Do we really think that the Lord couldn't do it with 11 men? Do we think that the gospel just wouldn't go anywhere if it only had 11? Well, it's not really about can we do it without him, but it's the fact that he had a spot, he had a place that he might take part in this ministry and this apostleship, that he might go to his own place. So similar with the apostles and the need for there being the 12, and that with Judas falling out, that there was an empty place that had to be filled, that needed to be filled. With Benjamin, it's not that could Israel have succeeded without Benjamin? Probably. It probably would have been okay. We obviously know that the Lord was going to come through the tribe of Judah, but it's the fact that there is a spot for Israel. There's a divine placement that needed to be filled. There was an inheritance that God gave to them, and surely if God already knew that Benjamin was going to bite the dust, then there would have been provision for who could have had the inheritance. That's one of the issues here. Is there must be an inheritance there in verse 17 for the survivors of Benjamin. There has to be the inheritance. So no one could just go in because there were no more Benjamites and say, okay, this is our land now. It belonged to Benjamin. God gave it to Benjamin, and there was no provision in the law for the transfer of such things. So as far as the feasts, again, there were 3 yearly feasts that all males needed to attend. This was later reinterpreted, that they needed to attend at least one of those 3. And as it turns out later in time, the largest of those 3 would be Pentecost that most people would be attending.
thus setting up the perfect time for the Lord to introduce the church on the day of Pentecost when most people would be there. That's thought for another time. But those were Passover, Pentecost, and Tabernacles. I think it has to be one of those three. I have an opinion. We'll get to that in the next question. I don't think it's a local festival. Again, we'll get to that in a second. Other comments before we move on? Okay, question number four from Bart. What was the solution proposed to ensure Benjamin's survival and ensure that their oath was not broken? Is there a feast in which such dancing was commanded or encouraged? And if not, what is going on?
Well, the solution, because they had taken this oath, whether or not they should have or not, obviously we're debating, but they had taken the oath, and so, as Bill pointed out, we should admire them for keeping a difficult oath. And so the solution then is kind of circular logic, perhaps, but we can't give our daughters to them, but if they're stolen by the Benjamites, then none of the men can be accused and be cursed. So that's their conclusion, and we might fault their logic, but that is the conclusion they came to. And so they decided at Shiloh they're going to go out and instruct the Benjamites to take women from the young women that came out to dance during this festival. And by doing this, two things are accomplished. Number one, the tribe of Benjamin is renewed, resurrected, you might even say. And secondly, the fathers of the young women are not to be blamed. And I like how you said we need to look at this through the lens of a 3,000-year-old story, not through the lens of our modern system. And they became wives, and I would argue they became beloved, respected, and adored wives, and became the founding families of the tribe of Benjamin, from which great kings came. King came from the tribe of Benjamin. So these women weren't treated disrespectfully after the initial grabbing in the dark. And this idea of virgins dancing is an old Mosaic system. Miriam and the women danced after the Red Sea crossing in the book of Exodus. That's Exodus 15, 20, and 21. In Jeremiah 31, the young virgins are told in the Messianic reign that the young virgins will be dancing. You shall be rebuilt, O Virgin of Israel. 75 times, this idea of godly virgin women serving the Lord is used in the Old Testament. And guess what? It's used in the New Testament. Matthew 25. Who goes out during the wedding ceremony in the dark? Mm-hmm. It's virgins with lamps. So yes. This is a theme that is found throughout all Scripture. I don't think we can ignore that. It's not just a random occurrence. This is something that is being pointed out. Were they allowed to dance? Yes, they were. Psalm 150, verse 4, under the Mosaic system, praise him with timbrel and with dance. And so David danced before the Lord. Did I answer? Is that it?
Okay. Yeah, I think so. With the topic of dancing, when I was reading this, my initial thought was, you know, what exactly is going on here? Is there some kind of a lewd connotation of what's going on? And there is not. And again, I think, speaking more modernly, maybe for the last, 60, 70, 80 or so years, the conversation in the Church of Christ on dancing have been kind of a blanket, thou shalt not dance whatsoever. And I don't know that that's necessarily true. Biblically speaking, I think certainly that the scriptures talk about being lewd and lascivious. Obviously, we cannot do that. But what's happening here is not lewd. It's nothing like that. I believe that this is talking about the Feast of Tabernacles. And the reason I believe that is Deuteronomy 16, 13 through 15 indicates that the Feast of Tabernacles was to take place during the grape harvest. And of course, this is where they're plucking their wives, if you will, from in the vineyards. And that would make sense that they are there if this is the Feast of Tabernacles. Also, Tabernacles was the most joyous of the three feasts. So that would really make sense that there is dancing, that there is joy that's taking place, and why this would be occurring this way. I would also say that
these are some of the questions that we need to ask too. Shall we say that this plan was so secret that none of the virgins had heard of it? And shall we say that none of the fathers or brothers had heard of it either? I don't think that we can say that definitively. I don't think that we can say that this was formed in such a fashion, this pact, that nobody knew it was coming, and that there was just a bunch of screaming and hollering because people were being kidnapped. Although this is less than ideal, we can all acknowledge that this should not be looked, as Bart said, through the eyes of modern readers' expectations for marriage and courtship. So when you talk about your wife and that she's a real catch, this is not what you're referring to here. And nor should we think that there is severe mistreatment being involved here, because there is not. And remember, chapter 20 was a whole war that was fought because of the mistreatment of a woman. So let's not think that suddenly that everybody's okay with mistreating women now in this particular place. That seems implausible to me. Other comments? Bill?
So I did a little math. Lauren and I like to do a little bit of math. So if 25,000 Benjamites were killed, and now we got 600 survivors, their value per Benjamite has now went up fourfold. I don't know how well this was nosed around Israel and prior to this catching of wives. Maybe some of these ladies knew these guys are going to be rich.
Mm-hmm. To that point, Kaufman had made a comment about that, or rather Matthew Henry did. The virgins of Jabesh-Gilead were taken out of blood and slaughter. But the maidens of Shiloh were taken out of the midst of mirth and joy. The former had reason to be thankful that their lives had been spared, and I think there's something to be said also about the salvation of those virgins and the fact that they were in the midst of people who weren't exactly on the Lord's side. So they were taken out of that and given to men who it seems were righteous. Their lives had been spared, and it's to be hoped that the maidens of Shiloh found no reason of complaint, for they found themselves the wives not of broken, defeated men, but of men who recently in a cave were actually the richest in all Israel, because they had now just inherited a whole bunch of land. This wealth came by reason of their having inherited all this. He says, we conclude this episode with a quotation from from Dr. George DeHoff, who stated that it's not known whether or not some of these Shiloh maidens made themselves easy to catch. I don't know how to respond to that, but I put it up here so that you all could know and think about that. Anyway, let's move on to question number 5. We need to conclude here tonight. For Landon, what are some lessons that we learned from the book of Judges, and how does the conclusion of the book leave the reader feeling?
So I feel like there's probably a lot of lessons that you could pull out of the book of Judges, and I've got a few here. Most of them are specific, going from looking at things from each chapter, or specific chapters, and then I'll have a few overall, but I'll just talk about a few from specific chapters. So from Judges chapter 2 and verses 1 through 5, the Lord talks about how Israel broke their covenant with him, because they had not driven out the people from the land. And because of that, he wasn't going to drive out the people, and he was going to make them a thorn in their side. And I think that can apply to us today. If we don't drive out the evil people in our lives, we hang out with bad company, that's going to happen to us. What happened to Israel will happen to us. Our values will be degraded. And if we continue to live in that sort of situation, we might become like Israel is. We might do what is right in our own lives. Judges chapter 6, it's Gideon. The Lord approaches Gideon. And Gideon there, he's pretty doubtful. He asked the Lord for multiple miracles to prove that it is him. And I think that shows us that not only does it show us that God is a very patient God, he's a very long-suffering God, but it also shows us that he doesn't expect us to know exactly what he means all the time. There is room for error, but as long as we diligently seek him, we're going to be able to come to the correct answer.
Judges 10. This is the chapter where Israel weeps to God, but God says, "Have I not done all of this for you? I'm not going to help you this time. You're on your own. You're doing this by yourself. Pray to Baal. Play to the Asherahs. I'm done." And I think from this chapter, we can see that if we let ourselves rely on God as our last resort, He's the last thing that we go to in order to fix our problems, that He's going to answer no. And it's not just if He's our last resort. God can answer no whenever He wants. And we have to be able to understand that and accept that. And we won't be able to get the outcome that we desire all the time. Judges 11, it's about Jephthah. And in there, Jephthah makes that vow to God, that famous vow where whatever comes out of his house, he's going to offer to God. Of course, it's his daughter, which he's not expecting. So I guess the first lesson might be that you shouldn't be too hasty. You shouldn't say things without thinking when you don't know exactly what could happen. And the second, I think the most important, is to raise your children like Jephthah did. His daughter there gives a response where I'm not going to remember exactly what she said, but she said, "If you made a vow to the Lord, you keep your vow." And she subjected herself to what her father vowed. And that should show her faith and strength. And so parents should try to raise their children like Jephthah. Judges 13, this is Samson's birth. In that chapter, the angel of the Lord appears to Manoah's wife. And when Manoah's wife goes to him, he'll be like, "I just saw God." He's like, "I'm going to pray so he appears again." He doesn't doubt her. He doesn't say, What? No, you didn't. You're crazy, man. He believes in his wife. And so I think a lesson we can get from this chapter is that one about the relationship a husband ought to have with his wife. You're supposed to be each other's best friend, and you're supposed to rely on each other and believe one another. Judges 16, I wanted to get another one out of Samson. And so I have this point about Delilah, where we don't know whether or not she was a Philistine or a Hebrew. Dad mentioned when we covered this chapter that her name's actually Hebrew. I think it means the moon or something similar to that. But I think it's safe to make the point or draw the conclusion that we need to marry those of the same faith or same ideals that we hold. If we don't seek out a partner who believes in the same things we do, they're only going to drag us down. We're not to be unequally yoked with unbelievers. And so that's all my specific chapter points. For the overall points, it says this multiple times, but Israel did what was right in their own eyes. And so I think the overarching point of the book of Judges is that we see what happens here when people are godless and when people forsake God, when Israel forsakes God. It's utter destruction, both physically, like we saw with Benjamin, and spiritually. And the same is true for us today. Destruction will ensue when we do what we think is right. And as for how did this book leave the reader feeling? Well, I think all the way up to chapter 17, it was a bit, you know, it was sad, it's dark. Israel keeps falling away. Many people die. And God has to send a judge in order to bring Israel back. And so the first 16 chapters are already pretty sad and depressing. But then you get into verse 17 and onward. And that feeling just gets worse because no judge comes to save Israel from that point forward. There's no redemption that happens. And especially when you get to chapter 19, that's probably the biggest kicker in the entire book. It will leave feelings of disgust. And then continuing on for the rest of the book, I think it's just dark you're unsure of how to feel. And, I mean, this was written for the Israelites. You know, Samuel or whoever wrote this book. This is exactly what the Jews would feel when they read this. They would feel disgusted about themselves, about what they did. And this was supposed to help them bring them closer to God, make them not want to make those same mistakes. And I think we here today should be thankful that we don't live in a time period like this. And we should be thankful that we have received the ultimate judge, which is Jesus. And I think that's the last thing that we would get out of this book is reading it here today after Jesus died on the cross. We realize that humanity does need a judge, and we've received the ultimate one.
Excellent. That's a great recap, both in the general and the specific. Really appreciate it. Man, we've covered so many cool things in this book. Really appreciate that. Any other thoughts here on conclusion of Judges? I'll just leave those up there. We'll go ahead and conclude for tonight. Really appreciate all the study that everyone has put into not only this chapter, but this book. And